Comedian Paula Poundstone is a regular on NPR's hit show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and she's here to talk about her new NPR podcast, new book, current tour, and give us her spin on our issues. Hi, Paula.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good.
Tell us about your new podcast, live from the Poundstone Institute.
Let's see. You know, I've been on a wonderful radio show on NPR, or made by NPR, called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I've been there for about 15 years, I think. And one of the things that happens on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is that the host of the show, Peter Sagal, my boss, he will every now and then cite a study. And he'll say it, or he'll cite the results of a study, and he'll say it as if it's sort of established fact. He'll say, like, cats are the only animals who don't forgive. And I go, wait a minute, where'd you get that? And he'll say, well, you know, a study was done at Stanford University or something. He'll say, how do you tell if a rhino has forgiven you, first of all? And who would fund such a study? And sometimes Peter knows the answers to these questions, and sometimes he doesn't, but it's always fun to pose them. And so we had this idea that we would do live from the Poundstone Institute, wherein I would get the chance to talk to the scientists and the researchers who do these studies. The number one goal of the show is to be funny, but it's funny while learning something at the same time. And by the way, when you talk to these people, it often turns out that there was a reason. You know, sometimes it just sounds like sort of a silly idea, but sometimes it turns out that there is a practical application for the information, that for the data that they've gathered. That's the backbone of the show. We do it in front of a live and lively audience. It's taped. It drops July 8th. Right now, we are located in a low-ceiling, high-energy, small space in the back of a comic book store in Hollywood. And so far, so good. So, you know, it's another way to have some laughs. It's another way to have some much-needed laughs in the world. I firmly believe the entire world is in a mental health crisis right now and probably will be for quite a while.
What do you hope to accomplish with this podcast?
Well, my number one goal is for people to, you know, just plain enjoy listening because it's fun. I mean, if I were to speculate about what I would hope for, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, it would be that we would stay in the small space. You know, at capacity, it seats maybe 70. I'd like to stay in that small space, but I want those to be the hottest ticket in town. I want people to fly in from all over the world to go see, to go be a part of the taping of Live from the Poundstone Institute. And I'm hoping that not only do they enjoy it, but that at some point, sales of the Poundstone Institute hoodie sweatshirts give me enough revenue that I can go to college myself.
Tell us about your new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness.
My book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, is a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And the question for me wasn't, I mean, right off the bat, I already knew going into it, the question wasn't what I would like doing. The question was, what thing could I do that would create a bounce, you know, that would give me an umbrella, so to speak, when I stopped doing it, an umbrella for the on and off, the inevitable on and off rains of one's daily life. So every chapter is written as an experiment with the conditions and the hypothesis and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. But the analysis part of each chapter is where I report on how things are in my regular life, you know, to tell if it's had this lasting effect. And it's the story of raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic for a living and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. And so in the end, the book is sort of the anti-Facebook, really, because I tell the down and dirty story of raising a house full of children and animals, you know, and not knowing all the answers and struggling to do the best I can. Whereas on Facebook, Facebook is a 24-hour-a-day holiday letter drip. You know, everybody posting their, you know, their best and their brightest, and look how lovely the children are. And here they are, you know, graduating from Harvard, and here we are skiing in Switzerland. I see these posts and I think to myself, gee, when my son was expelled, we should have gone somewhere.
What was your inspiration for writing it?
Well, it was twofold. I can't tell you that it was entirely selfless. First of all, I figured that by doing these things that I or other people thought would make me happy, I figured it would be a good playground for writing jokes and for writing funny stuff. And I always knew that it was also a framework for a memoir, which I get to keep writing because I'm not dead yet. And here's the, all right, here's perhaps the least altruistic part of the whole story, which is I really hoped the publisher would pay for the things that I did. You know, like if you said, oh, I'm going to rent a Lamborghini for a week, that the publisher would pay for that so that I could do the study and get the results. That's not what happened. And by the way, I didn't rent a Lamborghini for a week. I rented it for a day. Whereas if the publisher had paid, I would have done it for a week.
You're currently on tour. How's that going?
Great. I love performing in front of an audience. I've done it for 38 years. And so in the Malcolm Gladwell outliers sense of the term, I guess I've almost become an expert. I think it, you know, like Voldemort, you know, sucking the blood of his victims, I think being with an audience who's laughing is the thing that that restores me to life. It's the best thing in the world for people, maybe with the exception of a walk in nature. Laughter is incredibly healing, and being in a room full of people who've come out to laugh for the night and I get to tell the jokes is, you know, helps my mental health as well as it helps the mental health of everybody in the room. It's just plain good for you. I don't know why nature gave us that, you know, and I don't know if other animals got it. I kind of think maybe raccoons did, and I think maybe certain dogs.
A few political questions. With the Trump administration, it seems like every day there's one upsetting crisis after another thrown at us in the news. What's your spin on all this?
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings. And the part of me that's not really tethered to reality, there are days when he doesn't tweet that I feel empty. If it was just a miniseries on HBO, it would be so damn funny. Unfortunately, it is, in fact, real life. And sometimes as I'm laughing at and are making jokes on stage about it, I keep flashing on that scene in Cabaret where Joel Grey is on stage and the camera has these big distorted faces of all the people, you know, laughing, you know, while the, you know, Nazis march somewhere. So sometimes I'm not certain that really laughing at it is enough. Perhaps not. And it's not his tweets that bother me. I mean, yes, there appear to be some sort of odd cry for help. But, I mean, probably if we paid less attention to that, and more attention, say, for example, to the effect that he's having on the world, you know, on our relationships with other countries, both good and bad relationships with other countries. You know, I think it is an unfortunate and untimely occurrence that Kim Jong-un is who he is and in the position he's in, and that Trump is who he is and in the position he is at the same time. You know, there's really a number of countries that have nutter leaders right now. We're not the only ones. And it's just a really bad cocktail. I'm not exactly sure what to do about it, quite frankly. When I heard the news the other night, I was watching the news hour, and, you know, they say, oh, yeah, Kim Jong-un thinks he has a missile that can, you know, go all these thousands of miles. Part of me thinks, well, great, I don't have to put away the leftovers. And part of me thinks, you know, oh, my God, what are we supposed to do?
With LGBTQ teens already four times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers after facing bullying incidents, what advice would you have for these kids struggling with Trump's administration?
I think that there are things that we can all do to make ourselves feel good, just things that nature has provided us. You know, in some of these situations, though, those feel like, you know, small weapons, I think, to someone who's really suffering. You know, finding supportive friends is harder and harder these days. Partly because of social networking. You know, I'll tell you, any kids facing the world right now are in a sort of working not even from ground zero because of the effects of electronics on our kids' social lives. You know, a lot of kids don't know how to look each other in the eye when they talk, and they don't talk. They can sit right beside each other and text. And adults like to make jokes about that because it looks so funny to us. And we act like it's just sort of a, you know, bye-bye birdie. Oh, you know, kids, what's the matter with kids these days? But it's well beyond that. It's affecting people's mental health. And when you already have the challenge of, you know, functioning in a world that can be homophobic and cruel. You know, no matter what challenge somebody faces, it is made worse by not having real interaction with people. I sort of challenge myself as I walk down the street to say hello to people, which actually is an oddly hard task sometimes because so many people are either staring at their flat thing or they have their headphones in, not intending at all to interact with the world around them. Sometimes you say hello to people, they act like you've interrupted them from something else, even though we're just walking down the street. I think every day should look like the opening scene from Beauty and the Beast, you know, with bonjour, bonjour. It used to be that way to some degree. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but it did used to be that way. So I realize it's not a solution, but I would say that anybody would feel at least slightly better if they made real contact with other human beings instead of hiding behind electronics.
How can people get information about you and your ventures?
I do have a website. It's paulpoundstone.com. Not too tricky. It has my schedule.
Do you have a favorite quote or mantra to get you through difficult times?
You know, when my life was at its most difficult, I'd screwed up badly. And it has been helpful to me to recognize that, all I can do is move forward. And so I've really made a very, very conscious effort to get up every day. At the time, it was, figure out how I could make my children's lives better and, sort of world around me. And now that my children are young adults and don't have the same needs for me that they once did, I mostly get up in the morning. And I in order to feel like getting up in the morning, I have to think to myself, what can I do today to make the world a better place? And sometimes I think I actually do. Other times I think when I go to bed, we'll have to try again tomorrow.